I don't know if you listen to the show at all, but it's kind of, we're kind of a chatty, rambly kind of thing. Little bit less formal maybe than some other places that you've been and other things that you've talked on. And I will also preface the conversation by saying that I am pretty deeply ignorant of this topic in general. I think it's an important one, but it's just, I don't have a lot of the background information here. So I'm going to beg your indulgence and as I ask some very stupid questions. But can you, at the top here, can you kind of introduce yourself and kind of give us your background?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. So I'm Haitian, first and foremost. I'm a specialist in governance and public policy. And I currently work for a peace-building organization that is based in D.C. And I mainly work on governance initiative, peace-building, civil society strengthening initiative, mostly in Europe and Africa. But prior to moving to DC, I have over, 10 years of experience working in Haiti in the government sectors, as well as in the private and the development sector. And I'm also involved in advocacy work with, Haitian civil society organizations and diaspora organization here in the US to kind of like promote a new approach, of the US foreign policy towards Haiti.
And can you give us your name?
Yes, my name is Jeff Skiprincy.
What is the peace building organization you work for?
Partners Global.
Okay. Can you tell me about your career in Haiti?
Yes. So I had I work in Haiti as a public investment manager for the Ministry of Youth. So that was pretty much in the public sector. I also work as an economic advisor for different organizations in the development sector. But my latest job in the government was as an economic development advisor in the cabinet of the Ministry of Tourism. So that was the most significant experience in the government in Haiti. That was prior to coming here in the U.S.
All right. Can you lay out for the audience what has been happening in Haiti the last month or two? And you kind of give us an overall view of the current crisis.
I think to talk about the current crisis, it would
we need a lot of context.
Yeah, there's a lot of context here, but I think Haiti has been experiencing a lot of crisis and Haiti has found itself in what I call an instability trap since Haiti became independent in 1804. And there are different factors that can explain that. And the two of the most important factors are, the weakness of the government, the weakness of the state that has been characterized by corruption and bad governance, and also a dysfunctional economy that is being captured by the elite. So when you have the interplay of those two factors, it creates some kind of cycle of instability that never stops, right? So, but there's also a few other important factors that go back to Haiti's history. For example, one of them is after Haiti gained its independence in 1804, Haiti had to pay an independent, what they called a reparation to the French colonizers in order for them to recognize Haiti's independence. And at the time, it was a lot of money. It was over 500 million, in today's dollars. This money was supposed to help Haiti develop itself as a new country. So that's one of the factors that I think play a role in Haiti's fragility today. And another factor could be the American occupation that people don't talk about that often, but that the U.S. occupied Haiti between 1915 until 1934. And during the time, there was a lot of all the resources of Haiti, the banking sector, and everything was under the control of the U.S. So those are like a few factors that kind of like play in the situation today. But in terms of the current crisis, It's a multidimensional crisis. And just to simplify it, it started after the assassination of the late President Jovenel Moïse. So at the time, President Jovenel Moïse was the only one in power. So the parliament was dysfunctional because the president didn't have time to organize the elections to renew the parliament. He also was in a lot of conflict with the judiciary. So when he was assassinated, brutally assassinated, the country found itself in a situation where there was no government at all. There was no functioning institution. The parliament was dysfunctional. The judiciary was dysfunctional. And with the death of the president, the executive branch became dysfunctional as well. So that created like a political vacuum. And this political vacuum kind of like facilitated the emergence of the gangs, which existed, you know, before, but that created an opportunity for them to become stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's kind of like led to the security issue that we have today, where the gangs control, I would say, 80% of the metropolitan area, which is where 4.5 million people live.
Is gangs an accurate word? I've been thinking about this as I've been reading about Haiti and kind of watching the propaganda that's produced by the gangs themselves. Are they just criminal enterprises, or do they have political aspirations? Are there ideologies here? Is there anything beyond just money?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And I think we can if we try to categorize the gangs in Haiti, they're not, you know, they don't have the same capacity. So the latest report suggests that there's about 200 gangs, you know, currently operating in Haiti. But I categorize them in three categories. So if I were to break them down, so the first category is what we call the first generation gangs, and those are, you know, local gangs that are involved in mostly in petty crimes, you know, opportunistic crimes and all that, and they're mostly driven by money and so on. And there are the second generation gangs, and those gangs are, you know, mostly entrepreneurial driven, business driven. So they're mostly involved in racketing and in, you know, crimes that bring some kind of economic return. And we also have what we call the third generation gangs. Those gangs, they are criminal enterprise, as you mentioned, right? So as criminal enterprise, they explicitly set themselves an agenda, like a political and social agenda. And that's what we've seen in Haiti lately. For example, if you've been following the news, you've seen that the gangs that were supposed to be rivals, they you know, came together to push the prime minister out. So it's a clear statement that they do have a political agenda, either to sustain themselves or either to promote somebody that would you know, protect their enterprises and their endeavors, their criminal endeavors in Haiti. So just to, you know, break it down, you know, it's I completely understand that the terms gang could be to some extent could be inaccurate, but if you break them down, the third generation gangs, they are, like, you know, mostly criminal, they are criminal networks, I would say, organized crime.
What do we have any idea, kind of like, what future these third generation gangs imagine for Haiti? Like, what does a barbecue want long term? What does an Izu 5 Second want long term? Do we have any idea?
Well, you know, first of all, I wouldn't want to put the focus on the gangs themselves, because if the gangs became, what happened in the first 5 years is that if we take into consideration the categorization that I just gave you, right? So we've seen like some kind of promotion within the framework, where like gangs that were, you know, first generation, they became second generation, and second generation gang became third generation gangs. So the problem is gangs mostly is a political phenomenon in Haiti. So it's inherently linked to politics. So that's why I wouldn't say that barbecue or any of the gangs, they have an agenda for themselves. I think they are being instrumentalized by, you know, like by other actors, to promote some kind of agenda. What exactly this agenda entails, I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. But just to mention that it's linked to, it's not only about the gangs, but it's also about the entire ecosystem that nurtures the gang, that fuel the gangs, and that create the condition for the gangs to sustain themselves, and so on.
So what are these, and I know you've kind of laid out the historical context for it, basically like brutal colonization and resource extraction over the course of more than 100 years. What are the systemic problems that give rise to these gangs? How is it that they have flourished?
Okay, so the phenomenon, as I just mentioned, of the gangs is rooted in politics, right? So the gangs are mostly being used and instrumentalized for political objectives. So if you look at the mapping of the different gangs in Haiti, you see they're mostly concentrated in areas that are very strategic when it comes to elections, right? So when you control like a, for example, if we were to have election today in Haiti, the gangs would have control over like 2.5 million of Haitian voters, which is a large majority of the Haitian voters, of the Haitian voting population, right? So those are like very strategic area for political reasons. And also the gangs have been used to suppress, mass protests, because most of the political movements, they always emerge from this, disadvantaged areas, from these communities. So they are being used to suppress protest and also to secure votes during the elections. So it's inherently linked to politics. So I think the other factor is, there are two very important factors that we tend to overlook when we're talking about the gangs, the conditions that make the gangs that powerful. First is the link between the gangs and the illicit networks in the region. So if you zoom out on Haiti's map, you see Haiti is right in the middle between South America and North America. And this is like a very convenient location for transshipment hub for all kind of illicit trafficking, including drug trafficking and all that. So one factor that create the condition for the gang to flourish, because illicit networks, they take advantage of Haiti being weak, Haiti not having the capacity to secure the coastline and all that. And the other aspect is the gang, the link between the gangs and the guns, illicit trafficking that are primarily linked to the US, right? So you have the gangs importing all kind of guns, and 95% of the guns and ammunition that the gang are using in Haiti, they come from the US, or they are being manufactured by the US. So those are like two factors that create, that I would say have a huge influence on the gang's capacity, on the gang's capability in terms of confrontation with the police.
What you're kind of saying is that Haiti acts as a hub in illicit trade of arms and illicit substances in the wider region, and that the gangs are a big part of this, and that there are outside players that have enormous influence on that.
Yes, absolutely, and this is what I usually call the transnational nature of the gang. Because if you don't have that, the gang won't, they won't be as powerful as they are today, right? Because if they don't have access to the illicit market of gun and ammunition, if they don't access to the banking system to launder money, if they don't have access to those illicit networks in the region, then they would just be first generation gangs that, of course, create problems, but not with this capacity of disturbance, this capacity of, to challenge rule of law and to challenge the police and itself.
So how do you solve the political situation there? you're looking at me like I just asked either a very stupid question or a very big question.
Well, first of all, I mean, when it comes to the gang, I think it's important to it's not something that can be resolved like in the short term, right?
No, absolutely not. It's a generational problem, it seems like, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the way to address that is to find a way to break this linkage or to erode the linkage between the gangs and the politician and the people from the private sector as well, because they remain one of the main enablers in, you know, for the gangs. So they create the condition for the gangs to exist, and to some extent they create the gang and nurture the gangs. So that's a very important aspect if we want to address this issue. And the other thing is the transnational nature of the gang, right? So there has to be some efforts, in the region to kind of like break this this linkage between the gangs and the illicit networks in the region. And for the guns coming from the U.S., there has to be some kind of coordinated efforts between the U.S. and Haiti and different countries in the region to make sure that, you know, they can address this issue, intercept the gun before they reach Haiti, and also provide support and assistance to the Haitian police so they could, you know, actually be up to the task to not only tackling the gang issue, but also to be able to control and patrol the coastline. And just to put that in context, Haiti has it's a 1,000 miles of coastline, right? And the Coast Guard of Haiti is like less than 200 officers with only one vessel. So it's literally like a open, you know, I would say open border in every sense for all kind of trafficking and all that. So unless we address those issues, unless we address those three components, which is the link between the illicit networks and the gangs, the link between the politician and the gangs, and the access of the gangs to the trafficking networks of guns and ammunition, it's going to be very, very hard to kind of like control this phenomenon.
And to kind of get on top of that, there has to be somebody in charge in Haiti, right? That's like an official government figure that is, you know, the president can't get in right now, right?
The prime minister,
this is like, again, showing the depths of my ignorance. The prime minister can't get into the country right now, right? So like, is there a path towards there being someone in charge that can kind of start to make these changes domestically?
Yeah, absolutely, and you're right, because the governance is the first step to address this issue, right? So you cannot address it unless you have a just enough governance, unless you have a functioning government that could at least give some legitimacy to the solutions that, you know, that you're gonna implement to address this issue. So as of now, the prime minister that you're talking about resigned. So yes, he wasn't able to go to the country, but he also resigned. And I know that there's a process to set up what we call a presidential college, which is like a body of different, people from the Haitian civil society and from the Haitian political sectors to come together to lead a transitional government. So this presidential college will have the task to appoint a prime minister, to form a government, and to agree on a set objective within the agenda, which I think would also cover the security aspect.
We had a conversation yesterday with a gentleman from a U.S. government department who I would say gave us like the American empire's view of Haiti. And it struck me that America has kind of constantly been screwing this up, holding Haiti back, almost actively tripping Haiti every time it gets up and running. And I'm wondering if you can kind of give us your view of kind of the history of America's involvement. I know you talked a little bit about the occupation in 1915, but I'm also interested in the 90s. I think it was 1994 that 20,000 troops came in, and what America's involvement should be now, if at all, and what's being talked about.
Yeah, first of all, I would be curious to know, you know, what you've heard.
I mean, we talked to Keith Mines of the U.S. Institute of Peace, which I thought was a very, which is a fascinating government agency that I had actually had not heard of before. Just that to be in Latin America and be near the United States is not great for the country often, kind of writ large. Like, America has imperial ambitions, and it has exerted control over all of the countries in its sphere of influence in one way or another. And he kind of outlined the ways that America and the, you know, international coalitions, usually through the IMF, are lending money, but there's strings attached to the lending of that money. And often Haiti has trouble jumping through those hoops. And also, you know, it had, as you said at the very beginning of the conversation, it started off kind of on the back foot because it had to pay reparations to the country that had colonized it. Right. And when you win a revolution and then are out of the gate, owe France $500 million. Fuck that, I think, personally. I just am curious about the history of American involvement and like how you view it and how Haitians view it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to put it simple, I think the U.S., you know, foreign policy towards Haiti in general has been a interventionist. I mean, follows an interventionist approach. I would say paternalistic approach as well. If you look through history, you realize that you know, every crisis in Haiti has the U.S. footprints and the international community's footprints in general, either as facilitator or as enabler or as sometimes as instigator. So this is a fact that I think that the you know, it's a fact, and you can see that throughout the Haitian history. And I talked earlier about the U.S. occupation. I also talk about this. We can also talk about the support that the U.S. has been, you know, providing to the Duvalier dictatorship. You know, and also even during the current crisis, right? So the U.S. has been acting as a counterforce to the you know, Haitian civil society that was trying to promote a Haitian-led solution to this very same crisis. And as a matter of fact, you know, when the crisis started after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, the Haitian civil society, you know, saw that as a critical juncture to promote the groundbreaking transition that would, you know, promote like a you know, social agenda that would promote that would break with the impunity with the corruption in Haiti, and ultimately the international community came in and appoint the then prime minister that just resigned, or the de facto prime minister Ariel Henry. And since then, they have been, you know, supporting Ariel Henry even despite the fact that he didn't have any legitimacy, he didn't have any constitutional basis for him to be a prime minister. So, and the Haitians have been promoting this Haitian-led solution for about 3 years, and the U.S. has consistently impeding this process to make sure that it doesn't happen. So now the I don't know the reason why. But that was a ultimate factor that made the situation worse. And the same solution that the Haitian-led solution that the Haitian civil society has been promoting is the same solution that is being applied today, but 3 years later. You know, so I think a lot of lives could have been saved if there wasn't this blind support of the international community, the U.S., for that matter, to the then Prime Minister, Aguilera.
All right, we're going to pause there for a break. Angry Planet listeners, we'll be right back after this. All right, Angry Planet listeners, welcome back. You mentioned the Papa Doc in there. And that was something that we didn't talk about. I mean, we had name checked him yesterday, but I would like to hear about who he was and the U.S. government's involvement with him.
Well, you know, Papa Doc is used to be as a dictator in Haiti. He was in power from 1957 to 1971, and after he died, his son took over and led Haiti from 1971 to 1986, and so on. And when he died, when the Duvalier son died, that's what actually ended the dictatorship regime in Haiti in general. And the U.S. support to the Duvalier regime was mostly, was related to what we call a great power competition, because at the time the strategy of the U.S. foreign policy was to contend the communism, you know, at all costs, and since the Duvalier was against communism, so it was that was an ultimate opportunity for the U.S. to keep supporting him, despite the fact that it was a brutal regime that was a dictatorship, and it was a brutal regime to the Haitian people. I'm very happy that I didn't have to live under a dictatorship. You know, I was born after the Duvalier, but it was a regime characterized by, you know, mass killing, you know, brutality of the Haitian people. Brutality of, you know, every force that represent a threat to him. And there wasn't, you know, freedom of expression, freedom, you know, there wasn't freedom at all. So I think that's the simple way I can describe this regime. But there's a lot of archives about the trail of deaths, of mass killing that he perpetrated in Haiti.
All right. Can you kind of tell me what you see as the political path out of the current crisis?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I think the first step now is to have a transitional governor. So this is a very important step, and that ultimately would lead to elections and so on. But the most important thing right now is to have some kind of government to make sure that we address the urgent issues, such as the security issue, and humanitarian crisis as well. But most importantly, I think this transitional government should lay the ground for free and fair elections, and that involve a lot. In a country like Haiti, right, that involves making sure that the environment is safe for people to vote, making sure that they instill enough trust for people to participate in the process, for the political parties to be involved and all that. And I think this is the path, this is the path moving forward. First, have the transitional government address the security issue, the humanitarian crisis, and lay the ground for organizing the elections to make sure that, you know, in the next 2 years, we have, we have functioning government with all of the institutions operational.
I assume that you are not a fan of this, this Kenya-led coalition of troops coming in.
Well, I think, so the thing is that there have been a lot of intervention of military intervention, police intervention in Haiti to address quote unquote the gang issue. But they all failed, right? And the Kenyan mission was the only solution on the table. Without Without any assessment of the security issue, without analyzing the failure of the past mission. And as a matter of fact, from a policy perspective, I don't see how it's gonna work, because one of the main characteristic of the past missions, military missions in Haiti, they were mostly focused on tackling the gangs, right? They were mostly focused on eliminating the gang. But what we've seen is that some of them, succeeded in eliminating some gangs members. For example, in 2007, there was a UN-led military mission in Haiti. So they managed to neutralize more than 800 gang members. But what happened after that? It took a few months or 2 years for the gang members to emerge again in the same areas and with virtually the same capabilities, right? So that tells us something. It tells us the fact that it shouldn't be focused only on the gangs. There's the entire ecosystem that fueled the gang that also should be targeted. Because what happened is you kill a gang today, you kill a gang leader today, tomorrow there's tomorrow a new one emerge. So that's the first aspect, is that it's not a multidimensional response. It's only focusing on the military aspect, and which make it a little bit more complicated to work. And the other component is, while we in the international community is mobilizing the Kenyan to go to Haiti, the Haitian police is collapsing literally. And just to give you an example, the international community is trying to mobilize 2,000, police officers to send to Haiti, 2,000. And it's been 2 years. They've been, trying to do that. The Kenyans committed to send 1,000, and there are like a few other countries that also want to send, police officers there. But in contrast, for the past 2 years, more than 3,000 Haitian police officers left the Haitian police. So, instead of spending, all this money to get people from other countries, police officers from other countries to go to Haiti, why not create the incentives for the Haitian police officers to stay and create the condition for them to be able to do the job? So there's a lot of things about the Kenyan mission that I think would be, factors for failure, to be honest. But I have to say that the only potential of the Kenyan mission is eventually what we call a military deterrent, So, if there's like 2,000 troops in the streets of, in a few neighborhood, then that would kind of like deter the gangs from seizing some of the important infrastructure, strategic infrastructure. That's the only benefit that I can see coming from that. But what is the cost benefit, right? So are we going to spend $200 to $500 million a year, which is actually twofold of the Haitian national police budget?
Are those the numbers that are being floated for this Kenyan force?
Yes, it's $200 million to $500 million, which is twice the Haitian national police budget, with 12 months to fund the budget.
Who's going to pay for that? Who are they charging it to Haiti?
No, absolutely not. There are a few countries that are committed to participate, in the funding basket. The U.S., I know the U.S., is committed to contribute, and Canada and also a few other countries.
What happens to a Haitian police officer when they quit the force?
So just to give you an example, as I just mentioned, for the past 2 years, 3,000 police officers left the force. And I think 25 to 30%, I don't have the exact number, but 25 to 30% left the country. Some of them left the country, and some of them, probably get to do other activities, or they go to private security, something. But the fact of the matter is they left the police force, right? So and right now there is around 13,000 police officers in Haiti, which is a ratio of 1.1 per 1,000 people, which is way below the standard, the international standard norm, which is 2.2 police officers, you know, for every, you know, 1,000 inhabitants. So just to give you, like, you know, an example of the construct, like the construct, because the if we keep focusing on outsourcing the security of the country, then it creates a situation where it creates dependency, and that literally undermine the capacity, you know, the potential of Haiti to be self-sufficient when it comes to addressing security issues. And that goes even further, because for the Haitian police officers would stay 9 months without the salary, you know, without getting a dime from the salary. And at the same time, we're trying to bring, you know, troops from abroad that will have all the advantages, right? Social protection, risk, premium, and all that. And they're going to fight along the Haitian police, you know, which are operating in very poor condition, with no social protection, with no risk premium, with nothing. So I think those are the, you know, important aspect to highlight, because we cannot address the security issue if we keep outsourcing security. So there has to be, the focus has to be on building the Haitian police capacity to make sure that they are able to address this issue, not only today, but should, you know, the issue arise in the future as well.
Do we have any idea what the size of the gangs are? You just gave us the size of the police force, and I'm wondering what, you know, the size that they're, of the force they're fighting is.
No, I don't have an exact number, and I don't think, you know, I don't take any.
It's hard to count.
Yeah, it's hard to count. It's very hard to count. But, you know, the gangs, as I just mentioned earlier, they're mostly located in the most disadvantaged areas, mm-hmm. in the very populated area. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of prospect for recruitment, right? There's a lot of young people, 60%. If I get that right, 60% of the Haitian population is under, you know, 25. So it's like there's a lot of young people that have no, you know, no other economic activities. So it's, that makes it like prone for violence, and it creates a ground for recruitment. So I would assume that there's a lot of, you know, young people involved in the gangs right now. But again, you know, not all the gangs have the same capabilities. You know, some of them are more powerful than others, and eventually are, you know, more larger in size than others.
And what do you do with the gang members when this is over? Let's say that something works. Haitian police are built up. A political solution is found. What becomes of all of these young men that are in these gangs right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of, you know, mechanism that could be implemented to address that. I think, there have been a few disarmament program in Haiti, but for some reason they didn't work. So I don't think that's a viable solution. And from a moral standpoint, I think the gang leaders, you know, should be either jailed or killed. And that's a fact, because they have been, you know, they have been involved in a lot of massacre and crimes. So somehow there has to be some accountability and justice for the Haitian people. But I do I do think that there is gonna be a need, you know, after addressing this issue, there's gonna be a need to massively invest in those community, you know, not in gangs, but in those community, to make sure that we create what we call a peace dividend to the people living in the neighborhood, including for the young people that, you know, got brought into the gangs, who, you know, because of lack of opportunities and all that. So I think that's a pathway to sustain the peace after when we get to that.
Can I ask you one more thing here at the end? Haiti's relation to the Dominican Republic and the Dominican Republic's responsibility, if it bears any, in this situation.
Yeah, I think we always had, Haiti always had a very complex relationship with DDR, and that goes back, you know, to history, you know, if you're aware of it. But I think in the current crisis, I wouldn't say they bear responsibility, but I think the gang problem is not only the Haitian issue, as I just mentioned. So we share 360 kilometers with off border with the DR, and there are a lot of you know, clandestine crossing points along the borders, and the DR could be very effective in helping Haiti addressing this issue. And as a matter of fact, some of the gangs, I mean, some of the guns and ammunition going to Haiti come from the, you know, cross the border and enter Haiti through to the DR. And I would also presume that there is a connection when it comes to money laundering as well, you know, because people use the gangs, they use the borders to transfer money here and there. So I think the DR could be part of the solution. So I wouldn't say that they are part of the problem. I mean, they could be because of different reasons, but I think I would emphasize on the fact that they have to be part of the solution in helping Haiti addressing this issue, especially when it comes to illicit trafficking of guns and ammunition through the border.
Who do you see as the Haitian political leaders that can step forward now?
You know, me personally, I don't think I reject the idea of having a messiah, like a political leader, you know, that gonna save Haiti. I think it's not the case. We've done that, and the Haitian people has been misled in so many occasions when it comes to that. So I think what Haiti needs right now is a, you know, like a large majority of people that are aware of the, you know, of the problems, and that you know, willing to change, that are willing to be part of a solution, that are willing to, you know, to create a rupture with the current system. And that's exactly what we need. I don't think the Haitian people needs a political leader, you know, per se.
Well, I think that is a good note to end the conversation on. Sir, thank you so much for coming on to Angry Planet and walking me through this.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. It's been a great conversation. Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode, Angry Planet listeners. As always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin O'Dell. It's created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like us, if you really like us, please go to angryplanetpod.com, sign up for $9 a month, get commercial-free versions of the mainline episodes. You should get instructions and an email about how to set that up. And you also get bonus episodes. There's a great one that's kind of a pairing with this that is up now. It's kind of the U.S. Empire's view of Haiti. It's pretty interesting. You should definitely check it out. And that is up there right now if you sign up at angryplanetpod.com. We've got another episode coming out later this week. It is a conversation with the former New York Times bureau chief for China about China and America's fraught relationship and what the future might look like. There's some nuclear war stuff in there. You know, it's the kind of thing that you've come to expect here at Angry Planet. That should be up a little bit later this week. We've got some other exciting things coming down the pipe. Stay tuned. Diner at the End of History. It's coming.